O Lord our God, truly Yahweh, the I Am who are with us, and also the Good Shepherd who is truly the I Am in our lives, because you certainly give your all for us, even to the point of laying down your life. So keep your presence very real in our lives, keep moving in our lives. In times of orientation, O Lord, let us just celebrate your goodness, celebrate it in ways in which we can shout it out to the mountaintops. In those moments of disorientation, Lord, when the valleys become dark and the valleys become deep, when evil is so very real, let us sense that your presence, that your rod and your staff may be the signs and symbols that you are with us, and therefore we have nothing to fear. And also as we move into those times of new orientation, those surprises in life, because your grace is manifest in who we are and what we are, we can celebrate that, especially as we know it so truly in the great surprise in your Son, Jesus Christ, our Savior. So in his name, bless us and be with us. Amen. Okay, in orientation. Now, some of you are here, I know, last week, and you heard, I always have to say that as way as introduction, but some of you just this week, we haven't talked just about an orientation. I'd like to just make a few remarks, just so that we know what we're talking about, and we don't take that for granted. And again, I don't want to be just repetitive. Times of well-being, when God is in his heavens all right with the world, we celebrate that, the orderliness of life, and dependability and reliability of God in life. That's something that we certainly can celebrate. Disorientation, when all of life comes apart, and when everything is disorientated, whatever that may be, it can be something trivial, it can be something very serious and critical, where we feel even the absence of God, the silence of God, the dark night of the soul, as one of the old church fathers would say. And we experience in the depths also a confrontation with God in a way we don't get out here when everything is prosperous and summery. And yet this is as real. And in a certain sense, it might become more real for us in this particular encounter. But we want to begin to note that as we study the Psalms, that we're always in movement, that we don't stay in one spot. And sometimes we're in different places, obviously, in this scale, at different times of our lives. But basically, we have this particular movement, at least theologically, that when we are at these times and we go into the valley and we are at the time of testing, as Psalm 66 will tell us, we're at a time of testing, and yet there's always the new orientation where God is establishing something new. Now notice, there's not a return out of disorientation back into just the old way. You're not just returning back. Once, if there is an honest, as we begin to discover in the Psalms, honest candor between Israel and Yahweh, you know how honest that is, you don't after that kind of dialogue and candor, there's no pre-candor situation, as somebody has said. All you can do is move on. And the moving on is because God has done something in the life of the psalmist, that there's something that has happened, and so on. And both the psalmist and the community of faith, they're surprised by God's grace. And I guess we've experienced it too, when there emerges in our life a new possibility that's really there, and it's not just something that can be easily sometimes even explained, because it's been wrought by the power and the goodness of God in life. And actually, that kind of newness cannot always be explained, and it cannot be programmed. You know, we say that when people are in the valley of the shadow, well, just give it another month and you'll be out type of deal. There is no programming of God's grace or God's surprises. No more, you know, can you predict or explain, you know, how the dead are raised and the blind see and the deaf hear. You see, that's not explainable, but it's a happening. It's a moment of grace. It's a moment when you have the new situation. And all the psalmist can do, all the speaker can do, is to bear witness to it and can recite it and talk about it and praise God. And that's what we experience in the Psalms. And maybe this comes back a little bit yesterday about, is there a different God in the Old or the New Testament? Remember that? I want to bring these very close together. Yes, sirree. And the psalmist is experiencing as much of the goodness and graciousness of God as any New Testament believer experiences this, except that we have the greater revelation because of the fullness of that revelation in that one, Jesus Christ. And so on. And the new situation, we will see, for us can usually be summarized in the resurrection. The resurrection event, the fact that the one who died for us was raised up from the dead, is the great surprise. Is the great surprise. Of course, we, quote, know it, but I mean on this side of the thing. That's the great surprise, even so that it becomes the bewilderment of the disciples. They have a hard time handling that. And yet that's what it is. And we want to know it again. When we talk, just to get ahead in the New Testament a little bit, thinking that any time you talk about resurrection being the key event to, let's say, demonstrate and bear witness to the great new orientation, the great new situation that is God created. We didn't create that. The great surprise of all of history and our history, that there is no going back to the old orientation. In other words, when we celebrate Easter, we're not just celebrating immortality. Because all immortality is an extension of the old orientation. Sure it is. Just think about that. People that believe in immortality means that they just go on forever and ever. Why? When everything is out of the old, everything's nice and real. I like that. This is very comfortable. I wish it goes on forever and ever, right? That's immortality. But the New Testament and the Old Testament does not deal. Hebrew has no concept of immortality. In the New Testament, they'll take that on because it's Greek thinking. It talks resurrection language. Resurrection language. Because what resurrection language is saying is not we're going back to something old. What God is creating is something new. And therefore the resurrection is something that's so new that the New Testament really says very little about it. It bears witness to it gloriously, but it really doesn't say much about it. Just think of it. All it says, when any time you ask, well, what is this fullness of this new orientation? And it says, well, you're going to become like he is. Remember that little phrase that comes out of John's first letter? All it says is the resurrected one is your preview. You want to see coming attractions? You take a look at the resurrected one. And that's all, but it doesn't give you much beyond that. Why? This is a Meyerism. Because I don't think that the... that isn't why we believe. You have to watch that. Go back into this to the Psalms. This is not why we are Christians, just to say, hey, what's coming, you know, kind of thing. We live in the presence because of the presence of the Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God in our lives. But another thing is, I do think that you're dealing with concepts that I this is me. I don't know if they are actually translatable. I mean, I don't know how you talk about four dimensions when we're three-dimensional people, for example. You know. I never have understood Einstein, even though you get the train is going this way and the train's going this way, which path, it's all relative. I read all that stuff, but I still don't understand. I think that the scriptures, you know, as Emerson Fosdick, the great preacher said, the New Testament doesn't give you the furniture of heaven or the temperature of hell. You know, there's certain limitations. And I think sometimes we get curious out there, and I think there's a lot of curiosity out there today, and you have to watch that. I think if we're going to learn something from the psalmist really has very little interest, if you ever notice, about what's going to happen after death. Did you ever notice that? There's very little. Everybody says, well, where is it? Because for the psalmist, he doesn't care about rewards of afterlife. That's not what he believes. The relationship isn't built on that. Whether there's heaven out there or no heaven is not why he wants to hold on to Yahweh. He holds on to Yahweh for Yahweh's sake. As long as Yahweh's within him, he doesn't care. Now, that's the faith of the psalmist. So it isn't, well, if you believe, you go to heaven. Oh, what do I believe? I want to go to heaven. See, the reward then becomes the reason for believing. But for the psalmist, that's why this life is so important to the psalmist. Not because he's a materialist, you know, the now kind of thing. But because in this life, he has Yahweh. And when that's it, that's all. What else do you need? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. I have no more needs. The psalmist is satisfied. We say, well, he wants him to heaven? Yeah. Well, why does he need that? He has Yahweh. You follow me a little bit on this. That's the thinking, and I just want to, we can't get into, quote, the death concept you know, that comes out of the Psalms, or that we talked about the pit and Sheol and so forth. There's a theology there that we should maybe explore at some time. And you can explore. But we're just trying to say the psalmist leads us up to something in faith that I think is dynamic and powerful, because it frees us to live up in the present. And that means we have no concern about the future. Why? Yahweh's with me. And he is everlasting. Remember that? I am dust, but you are everlasting. Okay? So what's the difference? You know, I mean, you have to get a little bit from that perspective to get into Psalms. And instead of somebody comes up and says, "I want, how come there isn't the resurrection in the Old Testament?" By the way, there is, you can read it, it's there. But you know what, you ever hear that kind of thing? You say, "See, see, there's a different, you have a different Bible there." There's no different Bible, different God. We can learn something, though, from the believer of the Old Testament, because they had something. That Hebrew, a psalmist had something, and we want to learn from that, because there's a dynamic in that for everyday life and living, and really lets the future to the one who's already everlasting, who's your God, you know. Which already talks about your destiny, if you want to think a little bit about it, you know. And it also lets you interpret Psalm like Psalm 90 a little bit, you know, certain psalms which I think speak very realistically about death and the fact that we are dust, but it always talks about the one who is eternal. And there's a little clue there that I think is very, for me at least, very uplifting. But the point being that when God creates something new and God intervenes, and the resurrection is the intervention in history, and it's in the resurrection that we believe. We believe in the one resurrected. So we say, "I believe in the resurrection of the dead." And people say, "How can that happen?" You know, they all get right away, we're confused, you know. What we're saying is that we believe in that whole new situation where God is creating everything new. New heaven, new earth, new song, right? Just listen to the New Testament. Look at how they talk about it, you know. It's not a reversion to the old. So we don't use the word, I know St. Paul uses the word immortality, but please take it in context the way he's saying it. 1 Corinthians 15. They use the word. But the immortality concept that was very Hellenistic in Greek, that is foreign to New Testament thinking. And it's certainly foreign to Hebraic thinking. No, they're over here. Yahweh, our God, the one who also became flesh and dwelt among us, creates all things new. So we are part of something that's new, not a reversion back to the old. And we celebrate that newness, even though in our present time we don't always experience it. You know, I mean, I'm still froggish. You know, I mean, you look at me and I don't look quite like the prince, you know, and so forth. And yet, when I look in the mirror of God's grace and in the face of my Savior Jesus, I can see the prince. And that becomes the miracle of God in our lives, this kind of thing. So we live in this tension. We don't want to get to all of that, but we live in the tension. But we want to make very sure the tension is caused because we're also part of this, even though we don't realize it fully in our present moment. But I believe that's a strong affirmation to the God that we have. And I don't want any of us to revert back. And it doesn't mean, now that I said that we don't have psalms that come out of the well-being. Now don't try to say, "I can't say any psalms here because I'm over here." No, wait. You don't take the book and put it in the boxes. We're not doing that. We're only talking this theologically, okay? Obviously, we who live over here, we can sing out the songs of orientation. We better, you know, of well-being. And that's a statement of faith. Someone said that the other day. Even when I'm in the valley, someone said, "In the depths, I can use these psalms." Of course you can. Well, that's not what I'm trying to say. The whole book of Psalms can be used as you are led by the Spirit to use them. These are just seasons of life that become experienced by the people of God. Okay, we said Psalm 23, right? Right, okay. Psalm 23. Someone, you made a comment before about Psalm 23 when I was sitting next to you. What? That's interesting.
This psalm will be the responsive psalm used tomorrow.
It's
a scheduled psalm for tomorrow.
And
the whole lessons and gospel are dealing with shepherds and sheep.
I planned it that way. You know, the truth, if you want to confess, you know, all truth and all that sort of thing, is that I didn't even intend to do the 23rd Psalm. And my outline, if you see my outline that I handed in to Norman Deers and to Elmer Witt, which we have to do being staff people, I avoided Psalm 23. And I avoided Psalm 23, and I think you know why. You know, it's almost a height of pretense that you can say anything on Psalm 23, and so you avoid it. Not because it's not one you don't want to use, but you're I don't know. I preach it with a little bit of fear and trembling. And it's because it's such a classic psalm, not just because it's part of our piety, but it is a classic expression of faith, and it's probably very rich. And so with this, I should take off my shoes. I'm on holy ground, huh? So on, as we get into Psalm 23. But let's get into Psalm 23. By the way, the Psalm 23, I guess, you know, you can don't get any season of life where that can be said. I think that's why it's such a classic. But I do believe, and Brigham puts this out, not that that makes it right, but he puts it into the area of new orientation. So I guess that's a legitimate time to talk about it and so forth. But we're going to talk about it from that frame of reference. And in the Psalms of New Orientation, you will find, by the way, we did study in Psalm 30 last week, and if we had time, I was going to do 66 also this week. You always find the summons for people to give God praise. And then there's a celebration because, quote, while I was in the pit or I was in Sheol, I've been redeemed. That kind of language comes along. Whatever happened in the psalmist's life is being celebrated because God has come into that life and did a divine surprise. And the psalmist usually then comes out of it by saying, I will pay my vows and I will, you know, that sort of thing. But always invites others to celebrate. Never can the people who experience the new orientation keep it to themselves. Silence is absolutely can't happen. There has to be more noise than that. And there has to be celebration. You often see that in the Psalms of New Orientation, that kind of explosiveness of joy and pulling in. And in Psalm 66, it's interesting, just while I'm rambling here, we always use the word Yahweh for Lord, but it's interesting, in Psalm 66, it doesn't use Yahweh, it uses the word Elohim, because it's a psalm that doesn't want to be exclusive and keep out the rest of the nations. And so instead of using the personal name, which is a name that's the name of Israel's God, you know, the covenant God, it uses the greater name of God. So all the nations, if you read that psalm, are supposed to come in and celebrate. It has a universal scope because of what has happened. The psalmist draws in everyone. It's really beautiful. And you find that kind of exuberance in God's grace in these psalms. But let's get to Psalm 23. I think that's where we want to get today. 23. Somebody, please read that.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever.
There's some movement here. I was looking for them. We'll just keep going lower here. There's a movement here that may just help us as we look at this psalm. And again, there is no, you know, if anyone here says, I have an insider, this is one place where we listen to each other as a spirit moves in a psalm like this. But we want to see that in verse 1, it begins with Yahweh. Begins when he says, Yahweh is my shepherd. And it's interesting, in verse 6 over here, Yahweh becomes the last word. I'm going to dwell in your house. The Yahweh is going to the house of the Lord. The Yahweh becomes the first word that's spoken. It becomes the last. And I don't think that's accidental. This is a poem. It's poetry. And I think that the poet here is using some very careful language. And if you notice that it begins with the third person as it starts. And it begins, the Lord is my shepherd, and I shall not want, and so forth. But it talks about God in third-person terms, the Lord and so forth. But it's interesting, when you get right into the middle, in verses 4 and 5,
you begin to get the word thou. And you get a thou relationship, and you get first person. And so there is some movement between Yahweh, you know, the Yahweh in the beginning and the end, and in between it talks about Yahweh in the third person, shepherd, so forth, he leads, and so forth, and so on. But in this middle section, you suddenly say, you know, it talks about thou. Thou art with me. Thou, thou. And it's because of this here that you say there has been a personal experience. And if this is the psalmist as an individual, David, as traditionally we accept him as author, or if, again, the psalmist is expressing the thoughts of community, the community has experienced this, the thou relationship is saying there has been a deliverance. There's been a disorientation, sin, but here the thou is with me, and certainly there's something new that has happened. And the psalmist is very quietly celebrating that. Very quietly celebrating that. But I don't know, this kind of a movement just may be helpful as we move to the psalm itself. Many of you are acquainted with Keller's book, Shepherd Looks at the 23rd Psalm. How many here? Can you read that? One, two, three, four. Yeah, by the way, a book, again, he's a shepherd. Philip Keller's a shepherd, and as a shepherd now, he is giving his comments. And his comments, I think, are eye-openers. I don't know if they always fit the Bedouin shepherds of the Judean hills. I don't know that much about sheep. I mean, what do people that are born in New York and live in Los Angeles know about sheep? I don't know. I only know, you know, what I read, et cetera. But it's interesting that we still use this psalm. Did you ever realize that? Why do I, an urbanite, use this psalm? It says something, I think, about the penetrating nature of this psalm. Because we do use it. Even though, quote, never seen a sheep type of thing. Oh, I've seen a sheep, yes. You usually see them in a distance as you go by in the car, you know. I'll tell you a story about sheep. When I was in the Holy Land, that goes back quite a few years now. My wife keeps reminding me of that because I think she wants to go back there again. And do you know how many years we were in the Holy Land? Okay. You have to know how to read those questions and also how to avoid them. And we were on the bus, you know, and our guide was Moses, not the original. Our guide was Moses. And by the way, the guides over there, at least in our experience, were exceptionally well informed, very knowledgeable. Usually collegians, that's the way I put them. And Moses was no exception. And I had several experiences as I traveled on those. Yeah, the big buses, big things. And the buses were neat, the roads. I'll tell you, this is smooth. And anyway, we're going along, and all of a sudden Moses stopped, you know. We look outside, and there are our Bedouin shepherds. They look like they just came out of the front page of a Sunday school leaflet. I'm not kidding you. And there they had the sheep, and they had a watering hole. And Moses says to us, he says, please take a look at this. He says, even I don't usually see this. It's a rare thing that we are this close and we're seeing something that you usually don't see. You know, it's just there. It just happened to be there. And the shepherd says, Moses, now watch this. And sure enough, the shepherds are all there and the flocks are all out there. And a shepherd would either say something or do something, call, and his sheep would come. You know, my sheep know my voice. There it was. And it was interesting how they watered their sheep and cared for their sheep and how they had their sheep, quote, not separated. Here's all these sheep out there. But already you could see everything that you ever, every insights that came out of shepherds there was happening. Even Moses. You know, I mean, he was a city boy too, I could tell. Looking out there. Tell you something about why. I one more upmanship on Moses I did. I was so proud. And so on. We're going down, and you always, at that time, that was 70. And that was 70, and that was at the time when you always picked up soldiers. There was always soldiers around hitchhiking. Maybe you know, maybe they still got to this day, I don't know. But they're always hitchhiking at the crossroads. And so we're going down, and Moses said, because we had 22 people in our total group, and the bus held about 40 or 50. It's a huge, these big buses, you know. And this is our little group. We had a little group, but it was super. And we were very covetous, too, because we were very, you know, this is us. And then we go, Moses says, you know, and I was the leader, because I had most of the group come to me and said, we have some soldiers down here, and he says, can we pick them up? They only hitch, and the way they get rides around the place is that they, you know, you pick them up and you give them where they want to go. But he says, it's your bus, so you don't have to do it. He said, but I want you to know if you want it, it's okay. And they always carry their weapons with them. You know, at that time they did, because that was after the 67 war, and they were still, everybody carried weapons, you know, and they always be lined up, you know, down there. And so I said, it's okay. I said, you know, we have some room here. If they want to pick up some soldiers, I'll look around. I got people, sure. Okay, so we're coming down. Here we stop by the bus. And old Moses says, that was nice. He was very happy about that. And I says, hey, Moses, yeah. You tell those guys out there to check their weaponry. I says, I want no loaded guns in my bus. I knew that I really said something that really irritated Moses. And he had to do what I said. It's my bus, right? Right, remember that. And so I said to him, do that. So he got out there, the bus, and here he is, the soldier out there, and he told them that they should, you know, make sure that their weapons are unloaded. Sure enough, they began pulling out clips and this sort of thing. And Moses came in white-faced. I never knew they were loaded. Not all the soldiers. Most of the soldiers didn't have them loaded. I mean, they didn't. You know, they always had them on the side. But he saw one or two pull their clips out. And he goes, I didn't know they were loaded. I always love to teach Moses something. I really do. I felt so good. But anyway, in that clip there, here was the shepherds and the sheep. And the Bedouin picture, and I said, even he stood and looked and watched, and we took some pictures of that. And here, a lot of these biblical references is how they deal with sheep we saw. And this was, what, 20th century? And I mean, they're just transplanted. I couldn't believe it. And black sheep out there in one section, white. He explained a lot of things at that moment. And it was a very little moving sight. So at any rate, we talk about shepherd. Now, it begins with the Yahweh, as we said, as a covenant term, and here is the covenant God, and I think we have to ask the question, Keller raises it, and I think it's a good one, is Yahweh, he says, does he have the credentials to be shepherd? That sounds very bold, but if we're in the psalmist, I guess we can ask that question. Is Yahweh have the credentials to be shepherd? Now, shepherd, again, is it one? Again, the shepherd, remember, is also a symbol of the king, or the ruler. We mentioned Pharaoh, for example, had the shepherd's staff as a sign of his authority. So shepherd is often a sign of the regal sovereign. And we have to say, is Yahweh, does he have the credentials to be that? So I can say I have no wants. Now, is Yahweh that much Lord in your life that you can say you have no wants? You know, you begin to cringe a little bit, at least I do. I have no wants. And because does he have that much in his character, you see? Because the I shall not want depends upon the character of the shepherd. And we ask that question. And the psalmist, he's going to proceed on this now. And says, yes, he says, Yahweh is my shepherd. He says, I can depend on it because he has all the characteristics of that dependability. Which is it's just an overwhelming statement of faith. Overwhelming statement of faith. And then he says some of the characteristics he's going to describe now. Why he has no wants, okay? And this is what he describes. And some of you who've used Keller, this will come to mind, or if you use some of the other commentaries, or know something about sheep and shepherds that I don't, which is probably, you know, wouldn't surprise anybody, because some of you may come from, maybe some of you are shepherds for all I know. I mean, I know who's always in the group here. Except today, it's interesting that sheep today, in America at least, from what I know, little I know, are very rarely led. They're always driven. Because they use them in the sharp herds, they use them with the jeep or the airplane. I'm not saying that's bad. I mean, that's just the way we do it. We do differently. We use sheepdogs. You don't find a sheepdog over there. There's no sheepdogs with the shepherd. The shepherd always leads. And the shepherd will lead and usually have a ewe with him or one of the sheep that the other sheep respect. There's always the pecking order. And we'll put a bell or something on it, you know, all these little tricks. And that's what leads. The shepherd will always lead the sheep. But over here, we drive the sheep, you know. So it really is a little different picture. But of course, we have huge, you know, hundreds and thousands of sheep. You ever see that on the hill? You go someplace. They didn't. They only had a few sheep. They had sheep they could call them by name.
And that was literally true. When Jesus used the picture of 100, you know, with 100, that was a big flock, by the way. I mean, that was a big flock. So who would ever miss a lamb out there, you know? We know who would. Okay. So he says that his shepherd there, he makes me lie down in green pastures. You know, I didn't know this. See, these are all surprises to me because of my background. But sheep, unless they lie down, they don't digest their food. I guess you knew that. Yeah, if they don't lie down, if you can't have a sheep lie down, I understand, and please somebody else comment on this, actually they'll become ill. They have to lie down. And I noticed that. He doesn't just lead you, you know, to the dining hall so you can stuff it in here. That isn't what it means. But what the shepherd is doing, he gets you to a place where you can lie down. Now, what I'm saying, it's more than he just gets you to green pastures. It says that you suddenly, because for a sheep to lie down, and Keller says that these are critical. And he says a sheep, therefore, to lie down has to be free from certain things. One, he has to be free, because they're very timid creatures. They're very timid, and anything startles them. They're like turkeys, in a sense. You ever know about turkeys? I didn't know anything about turkeys till I went up to Turkey Land up there in the middle of Sandwich Valley one time, and they raised these, and so forth. And I found the number of millionaires that lived out there. I knew what the value of turkeys. But anyway, it's turkeys. And the turkeys, you know, they can have their turkeys. They can lose their turkeys overnight because of a rush, or they get frightened, and they all ram together, and they all kill each other. I mean, it gets the hurt. And I guess sheep are a similar timidity. At any rate, unless there is they're free from fear, they won't lie down. Secondly, they said that their social behavior of the flock is interesting to watch, because there's always the pecking order, and sheep will really irritate each other. They know how to do that, shepherds say. They know how to irritate each other. Why does the Lord call a sheep? I don't understand this. But anyway, they know how to irritate each other. And when they irritate each other, and there's a lot of discontent. I mean, this is social discontent this isn't the wolves out there. This is social discontent. The sheep won't lie down either. And he said another thing is, they have to be also free from, of all things, they have to be free also when they're tormented by flies. We don't understand what that means, but they say if they're tormented by flies or by parasites, and they, I guess, they get up their nose and so forth because it's wet, and it can drive a sheep literally crazy. So the sheep will also run, and in the running will hit itself against something and kill itself, and you've lost a sheep. So that has to be free, you see, from these kind of irritations which come into life. And the sheep won't lie down. If there's too many flies around, the sheep won't lie down. And aggravation. And also, it has to be free from hunger. The sheep won't lie down if it's hungry. Now, my shepherd, he makes me lie down in green pastures, which is saying, again, that conditions, you know, can only be provided by a shepherd. The shepherd is the one who makes sure that there's no irritation. There's nothing out there that's going to frighten them. A good shepherd will make sure of that. A good shepherd will also make sure that there's social misbehavior. And Keller says that when there's social misbehavior and he can sense that in the flock, they're not lying down, how does he cure it? The shepherd walks right out there. And the sheep then see the shepherd. And there's a relationship there. He says that, fortunately, sheep forget their social irritations very quickly. But when the shepherd comes in, they forget that, and then they go back, and they're content again. The presence of the shepherd. And also the shepherd comes in and makes sure that they're free. We see it, you know, from the ticks and all these other things like that. And, of course, that they're fed. But the point is, a good shepherd will provide a way so that they lie down. Lie down means they're content. And if they're content, they're healthy, and everything is digested, and they're well. So that picture, maybe some of you knew that. I didn't. I think it's a beautiful picture. And but that's the way the shepherd is. That's the way Yahweh is for this individual or for this community of believers. And he leads me beside still waters. Why still waters? Why still waters? Have you ever noticed that? He doesn't say he leads me by the waters. He says he leads me beside still waters. Why still waters? Someone had it this morning in the early class. Sheep can be thirsty, I understand. And by the way, but if you have a rushing stream like you do down here at the creek, you know, A sheep won't touch that, even though the sheep is thirsty. So the shepherd will take and dam up some water and make a little pool so the sheep will drink. How dumb you say these sheep are. Watch it. Watch what the sheep... Watch that. Watch it. What you're saying here. What the psalmist is implying. Yeah.
Before we came here, we visited our son who was a counselor at a Bible camp, and they have sheep as pets, sort of.
Yeah.
Have about a half dozen. And he said the sheep are so dumb they forget to drink. So they have to watch them.
I didn't know it was that dumb.
No. So forget. So they decide to sell water, they forget about it.
By the way, yeah, it's true. The sheep, though I understand, I remember there was, we used to visit down San Diego, and one of my aunts and uncles on my mother's side lived out by Spring Valley. I don't know if you know the territory out there, but at that time, that was country. That was by El Cajon, that was country out there. And right now, you know, it's all up. But so we used to go out there, you know, and visit. So next door, their neighbors had a lot of animals, including sheep and goats. And so we go next door, because my little son Kevin and also owns the sheep and goats. So we go over there, and we go in and we pet and so forth, if you can. And then my uncle said, I remember that, he says, close the gate so the sheep doesn't get out. And I says, what about the goat? And he said, we don't care about the goats. They can find their way home again, but the sheep will never get back. You know, and here was the sheep. You know, and I said, oh, the goats could make it, but the sheep wouldn't. I said, ye cats. All right. But no. But you begin to say, it's saying, you know, I think we have to get back to, past even the, use the word sentimental pictures here. And we begin to see some of the thing when the Lord, when you say, the Lord is my shepherd, he leads me beside the still waters. Because he knows that I'll forget to drink. And he also knows that even if it's there, unless it's something that I'm not afraid of or doesn't threaten me. And sometimes, you know, even the refreshing waters of God threaten us. And so he has to give it to us in pablum form, I guess. I don't know. But really, listen to the care of the shepherd, the sensitivity of the shepherd. I think it's really remarkable. There it is. There they are. Look at this. Where are they going? There they go. There they're coming down. Yeah, here, I forgot it was New Year's Day. I just thought it was Saturday. There they are. Oh, man. Crazy Holden Village. I'll tell you, you never know what's happening, what's going on. Yes, sorry. Paula had a point there. By the way, yes. A good shepherd, not only the pools like that, they lie there dormantly, and they always become filled with parasites very quickly out there in the east, and so forth. It's not, you just don't lead them any place to drink. You have to lead them by the fresh water, not only the still water, but the fresh water. That's very true. And again, the sheep, you know, they don't know the difference between the two. Again, notice now the dependency of the sheep upon the shepherd, how critically the shepherd is for the sheep. And so on. Let's just keep moving here. This is an interesting one. Maybe some of you knew this too. He restores my soul. And I said, well, the Lord restores my soul. What does that mean? And this is Keller. Now, he says, this really what this is referring to, and of course I have to lean upon a shepherd here. He says, it's referring to the fact that about cast down sheep. Cast down sheep. Maybe some of you know this. I never did. Cast down. Cast down. He says this is an English term, the way the English shepherds have used it. And they call about it, they say this is a cast sheep. You leave off the word down. Cast down sheep means the sheep either because of its, the immensity of its wool or because it's fat or because it's pregnant type of thing becomes top heavy. Yes, you're saying nice. And they fall over. I didn't know this. And all of a sudden they can't get over like a turtle.
No, they don't. I've seen it happen.
Oh, would you? Why don't you share a little bit? This is new for me.
Either a fat lamb or a pregnant ewe will get outside or in a little bit of a depression.
Yes.
And unless somebody helps it up, it'll lay there and die because it can't get up.
The gases, I understand, fill up the room or something like that. The gases will kill it.
Bloat.
They bloat it out, yeah. And also, what I've read is that when that happens, the vultures can spot that quicker than you can. And they begin to circle. And what I read is the shepherd, if he's sharp, the shepherd's sharp, you'll see those vultures. And right away, he'll get over to that particular field or pasture where it is. Sure enough, more than not, there'll be that
that sheep turn over, cast sheep. And of course, you have to right the sheep up, and they rub the legs to get the circulation going again. All of a sudden, whoop, off goes the sheep dancing, you know, again, and so on. But the point is that you talk about being restored. I never knew that. It's interesting. You've seen that, yeah.
Well, I have a question. It seems to me that we could also look at this. I guess I've always looked at this not to deal with sheep, that verse is just still waters as being a calm time, and,
yeah,
and our soul is refreshed. But
yeah.
Interesting that there's
that. Well, no, wait. Let's listen to that, because this is one approach. This psalm, by the way, is bigger than all interpretations, because you're dealing with Yahweh and your relationship. And so, you repeat that again. I think that's good.
Well, when I think of He leads me beside still waters, I think of calmness,
mm-hmm,
and quiet, and not the everyday rush of life. Sort of like being at Holden Village.
Yeah.
And He restores my soul. Well, I feel like I've been restored this week, and I'm sure.
Beautiful. Yeah. Again, experientially, you know, we approach the Psalms and begin to speak to us. I like yours almost as better, I think, because of my experiences. I just mentioned this cast down because here the shepherd says this is where he read it. And I thought it was an interesting insight of being restored. But either way, I think you see how the shepherd does come in and restore us, because we need that, especially if you're cast and helpless. Really, that's a frightening experience. Anyway. And so on. Thanks for chiming in on that. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for His namesake. Again, Kellers and others make a big thing of this. My watch. Big thing of this. Of sheep, always have, they have the notoriously, they're creatures of habit, and they get into ruts, literally. And they will graze and overgraze a section. And then their own feces, their own wastes, then become the breeding ground of parasites, and they live in that, and it grows in them, and so forth. So if a shepherd doesn't keep them moving, he's a good shepherd, always keeps flocks moving from place to place to place to place. Something else that he says, and he says it later on, and I got to read this, about goodness and mercy shall follow me. He says, you know, if you lead sheep right, they'll leave their goodness behind also, meaning, yes, they'll fertilize, he said. And he uses several illustrations here, and that's why he talks about the golden hoofs of the sheep in England or something like that, because if they use correctly, land that has been poor land will become rich land. If you know how to graze sheep, I always thought that they were detrimental, but he says, no, if you do it right, it can be very, not detrimental, very effective to increase the prosperity of the land, the fertility of the land, and bring back land again. He used several illustrations from several countries. So I guess that's true. That later on, the goodness and mercy shall follow. He says, if you do it right, he says, it follows for Christians too, and he used several illustrations. But at this point, the sheep get into ruts, and they overgraze, and therefore the shepherd has to keep them going. And I said, in my life too, I get in ruts. Oh, I just said, that's so true. I need the kind of management the Lord gives me. Sheep always need to be led. Now we come to that one passage, I guess. Did you ever notice how I don't know how it is you, but usually when you have you go to a funeral and the mortuary gives you that little pamphlet which you have the information on the deceased and their family, on the back side is the copy of the 23rd Psalm. And so the 23rd Psalm, either fortunately or unfortunately, has always been associated with death or funerals. I am very careful, by the way, as a pastor, to use the 23rd Psalm when a person is seriously ill in the hospital, unless I can really know that person, because I've done it and the people said, I'm going to die because he read the 23rd Psalm. That's true. It's a psalm of death for them. And therefore, to show you, you know, how you have to read people. And don't say, oh, you stupid people, it was wrong. No, no, no. When a person's in that condition, you better read that person as a pastor, and you better be a shepherd at that point too. And I'm not saying as a pastor, as a friend too, you know, when you come in there. So many times we try to say the right things, and the very thing we're trying to say works against us, and so on. But still the same, this verse, the valley of the shadow of death. And I said, why do we always identify with that? Here again, it has been said by
people from the Mideast, that, quote, they know, quote, I was kidding, they know the valley of which David was speaking about. I'm always glad they know the valley that David was speaking about. But it was a valley that went from the lowlands to the highlands, and it was a very narrow, rugged set of canyon cliffs as it went up, and it actually cut off the sunlight, even in midday. And so it was always called the Dark Valley. Now, you can take or leave that one, whether or not they have found that, or if that's what David's referring to. But nevertheless, it was said that it's so dark and narrow, even to this day, that the sheep is always a one-way street. In the morning, it's one way, and the evening, it's the other way, because if you ever meet, you can't turn your sheep around, and you're stuck. So narrow and dangerous is this valley, and this is the Valley of the Shadow. Well, you can't prove that or disprove it. But but one thing we can say about valleys is, and Keller makes this assertion and others, that usually you lead sheep from the lowland to the highland. I mean, that's usually the direction. Now, if you keep that in mind, and the only way you get from the low to the high is through the valleys. You don't go over the peaks. You know, it's always the valley and the gorges that you follow. That's their trail. And so, as someone said, the Lord takes us to the valleys because he wants us to get to higher ground. And isn't it true in life, in our own life maybe, that we're in a valley? And we don't enjoy the valleys, by the way. I'm not saying the valley is, a valley is a place of where fear sets in. It's a very real dark place. The darkness of the soul, the dark nights of the soul. Where the valley is, this valley they're talking about, sometimes is such a curvy place, you cannot even see the shepherd. That's why the shepherd, they often use a shepherd flute. So you can hear the shepherd if you can't see the shepherd, and so on. And so sometimes we can't see God. Remember the wintry night of the soul, when God is silent and you feel, where am I? You know, everything is dark. This is dark. And it's very real. And the pain and the hurt and the doubt and all these things that set in. So I think we can say yes, we can experience that. But as real as the darkness is, so real is the presence of Yahweh. The I am with you. When you're ministering, I say you, when you're ministering to others in their moment of grief, let's say they're in the valley of the shadow, whatever that valley may be, and they're in extreme grief, you know, you always come up to that person and you don't know what to say. Do you ever know that? And I find out, and the grief can be of many things. It can be death, it can be divorce, it could be, you know, the real heavy things of life. And you don't know what to say. And so many times I have found, because, quote, people don't know what to say, they back away. They're afraid to even contact, you know? And you felt that way, I'm sure. And you don't know what to do, and you back away. And then the other person thinks that you're rejecting them. You know, the pastor, I hear both sides. And so on. And it's true. And they say, well, here comes the pastor. He knows what to say. Oh, I tell you, I've won so many situations. You walk in and expect some kind of divine revelation, you know. And I've learned over the years, and there's several, I know pastors here, maybe you can comment on this too, is this. You go into the room, and let's say it's a sick room, and a person's dying, and you're in a very, very dark situation. And I have found out, it's not so much what I say, is that I'm there. And by the way, this is Richard Meyer saying this, you know. I don't come in, you know, it's not some great giant of a huge, you know, big Christian. This is just me. And I want to say that to you too. So many times, if you don't know what to do with somebody who has death, you go over to their home and visit, just go over and say, I don't know what to say today. Can I just sit with you? Sit and cry with them, I don't know, you know. Sit down and make coffee with them. Go out and make the tea, whatever it is.
Or to give them a big hug.
Big hug, yeah. And just touch. But the idea of the presence. Because you are the body of Christ. Now take that seriously. Take that for what it means. You're the extension of the presence of the shepherd. Very much so. And sometimes all you can do is be there. And just be with the person. And be there. Also the following week, be there. And the following week, be there. Yes. And when you think the person should have got out of it, you know, what's the matter? That person's still there, you know? Oh, please, just be there. It's the presence. And I think that is what is also, Yahweh again is the I am. The I am. With Moses, the I am with you. And that's all the psalmist needs. And he has no wants, not even in the valley, you see. There's great power. I don't know if anybody wants to comment on that. Or the rod is the... We heard about a rod. The rods, they make it, the clubs, they make it, and they carve it out of the root and so forth. Maybe some of you know more about this again. The root. And they say that the shepherds... See, shepherds don't have much to do. I mean, they're watching the sheep, but what are you going to do all day? You know, you have to do something to wake your time. And so they often practice using how to use what they got. And they say they are fast with that club. To this day, contemporary shepherds, they had still used their old club. And you say, well, gee, it's too bad they didn't have a gun. You know, I'd have a gun. That's true. And Keller says he has a gun. He goes around. He keeps his gun there. And we would all have guns, you know, to protect the sheep. If something comes up, the wolf, the coyote, you know, you protect your sheep. But they used to use clubs. And he said he was with one, Keller makes this thing. He's with a shepherd. I think it was in Spain. No, it wasn't Spain. It had to be, he was visiting in Africa. It was Africa. This guy Keller's all over the place. He was in Africa there. It was an African shepherd because he was studying sheep and shepherds. And they were going along and they were preparing the table. That's exactly what they were doing. And he says, he picked up the rock and there was the cobra, the snake, you know, one of those things, whatever snake it was. There it was. And he says, before he could look twice, he said, the club went right through that snake's head. Why? Because the shepherd over there that was working with him never let the club out of his hand. Always with a strap next to him. Saw it, choo! You know, just as fast as lightning. You know, fast, you know, that kind of a thing. And Carol said he was impressed. But I'm just saying, when we say the rod and staff, we have to begin to get to how efficiently they could use what they had. And the staff, of course, was the one that was always a place of comfort. Another thing I didn't know this was this, about the staff and little lambs, that the shepherd never will touch the lamb. Why not?
And the mother will reject it.
The mother rejects it. I didn't know that because it smells human beings on it. I didn't know that.
Same with some birds.
Huh?
Same with birds.
Oh, yeah?
Baby birds.
Yeah. So when you do, what you do is, when the little lamb is, you have to get it to the right mother, you know, the shepherd, comes down with a staff, picks it up, takes it over.
They also, Keller also said that crook was used when they would fall over a cliff or something, he could pull them up.
Yeah. Sure. Anyway, but and the sheep somehow, he said, they know the staff, and they like to rub against the staff, and so on. Luther says, of course, I mean, come on, the rod and the staff is the Holy Cross. Yes. You see, right away, Luther told you what it was. You have to know a little bit about good Brother Martin and so on. Not too bad. Again, you know, you say, oh, that's... No, you just think about that a little bit and you say, I guess, you know, you can say that. The table before me, we already talked about that. Clearing the mesa, the table. Because there's... I did know this too in the different weeds that are out there. Some are weeds and they look the same as the good stuff. And you have to clear it and prepare it. Anointing my head with oil. Again, hey, do you want the formula for flies? Don't say when you leave this class you haven't heard something practical, okay? Here you are. Now this is a Keller antidote for flies. Because the sheep, if they get too many flies or things on their head, remember, they go crazy type of deal. And so therefore the shepherd is always going around with ointment. First of all, the cuts, I guess they bruise easily too. Even with all the wool, I guess the heads bruise easily. And they always are checking it out because they can get infections. But he says, here's your antidote for flies. Take your pen. Okay, here we are. It'll work. I think just listen to it. You'll know it's going to work. You mix a mixture of linseed oil, sulfur, and tar. So forth. Just put it on. It's going to work. Okay?
So when you...
I guess so. I gave you something now. Don't say you haven't left here without something practical. All the whole class, I can see going out there. Also, he said, another thing, this is interesting, another thing too. He says in the season, I remember of the mating, the rams are always hitting their heads against each other, you know. Just about that again, the symbolic. Anyway, but he says they can actually hurt each other and break necks. He says they can damage each other.
And so you can't stop the process, but what you can do is avoid the problem. So what he does, he puts axle grease on their heads. He says, it's fun watching. No, but the shepherd again, the shepherd coming in, and what is it to anoint the head? Well, I don't think the axle grease is what David used. Obviously, this is something contemporary. But I think we're saying, wait a minute, the anointing of the head is a healing thing it had to do, you know, with taking care of the sheep who cannot take care of themselves. And again, to use this thing of their cup runneth over, I think is the way that they are led to water. But again, several shepherds that I have read, not just Keller, but other commentators say, this is where the sheep actually give them some kind of a nip. Yes, yes. Keller says he keeps a little flask of brandy and water in the back. Of course, he does it in the cold country. I mean, real cold country. He says sheep can always take cold, up to an extent, but sometimes the young ones, you know, get super cold. And you pick them up, he gives them a nip, and then they frolic around and so on. That's what Keller does. So on. So, you know, keep that flask handy there, I guess, is what you're supposed to do. But all I'm saying is, again, that the shepherd really knows sheep and knows how to take care of them. Let's just wrap this up because time is here. Certainly, goodness and mercy shall follow me. By the word follow in the Hebrew doesn't mean follow. It means pursue. Yeah. Did you know that God chases you with his goodness and mercy? The word mercy here, by the way, is where translators here did not say steadfast love, as they usually do. It's the word chesed, is that covenant love, that his covenant mercy is going to chase you. See if we can outrun God's grace. You know how we are, sheep. We're always trying to outrun God's grace, and he chases us and catches us, always, with his goodness and mercy. Yeah, like the hound of heaven. It's a beautiful illustration. But that's in your Bible. Put that, cross off the word follow. Put down the word pursue. Chases me all the days of my life. And I'll dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Which gives us a great vision of our future.